I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Steve Harris. He's a river guide. He is director of Rio Grande Restoration, and he's a teacher of river and flood rescue for government agencies. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 28th of April at 11 in the morning, talking about the Rio Chama Flow Project, which is a presentation of Journey Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk about the Rio Chama. This is, as you write in a small publication that you have about the river, a very managed and regulated river.
It's not only the largest tributary to the Rio Grande, it is truly one of the sources of the Rio Grande. It's also got three reservoirs that control its flow. So I'm going to assume your next question is about what does this project do? And it's attempting to reoperate El Vado Reservoir, the one right in the center that it's built in 1936 to store irrigation water, to try and provide more natural flows and, we hope, some ecological benefits.
So when you look at the Rio Chama River, you're, in a lot of ways, to me, it's like a microcosm of the West, because what we've done all over the West is dam rivers to do irrigation and to do human projects, which probably at the beginning seemed like a really great idea and had a lot of unforeseen ecological consequences.
Yeah, we get lots of benefits from having the storage capacity. We can take the abundance of spring runoff that we get one year and regulate it out so that we have water for irrigation, water for drinking, water for all these human uses later on in the season, and then from year to year. Reservoir storage is what enables us to get through a drought year like this with a reasonable water supply.
And so there's several dams on the Rio Chama. How are they affecting the river ecosystem?
Well, maybe it's good to look at the history and what these are for, because each one has a different purpose. So El Vado was built in 1936 by the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District, and then more or less mortgaged to the Bureau of Reclamation back in the 50s. So Reclamation operates this reservoir to do that, to provide irrigation water more or less on command. Upstream of it is the Heron Reservoir, which is a lovely sailing lake. It's an oake lake. But it also stores water that we've imported from the San Juan River Basin. So a number of contractors have the water, but the largest of those is the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority. So it stores transbasin water that Reclamation, again, delivers to these cities and counties, including Santa Fe. And then the third one is Abiquiu, which was built to control floods so that we didn't have flooding problems in the Albuquerque area downstream, and then was later reauthorized by Congress to store Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority water that's, you know, for about the past 4 years now has been the major source of drinking water for Albuquerque. They've gone off more or less unsustainable groundwater pumping and use this water out of Abiquiu to supplement their water supply. And so all of these reservoirs are operated according to their own mandates. So you'll get to the end of the year, and the law that governs Heron says, well, you've got to get your this year's contract water out of there. So you'll have flows that are essentially dumping water out of Heron into the reservoir, and to these contractors. There's 10 of them that are entitled to various amounts of the water, and you can understand how El Vado is managed. They store the peak spring runoff, so you have less frequent, less high floods, and that water is regulated to come out in July and August when the farmers need it, and there's not much in the main stem river. And then Abiquiu also has its own mandates, which are principally the needs of the Albuquerque-Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority's utility municipal water system. And in sum, all of these purposes and traditions and how they're operated don't look much like the way the river operated before the reservoir. So we've knocked off the peak floods. That means the river stays in a given channel and doesn't have an opportunity very often to get out onto the floodplain, so that everything that's out on the floodplain is pretty stable. And that's contrary to the way nature works. When you get a big high water runoff year, you get floods disturbing the floodplain, and it makes it a more dynamic system. There's a more diversity of different kinds of habitats. Some of the cottonwoods stay, some of the cottonwoods wash away. Bare sand is created in a lot of these areas by floods that then are the germination point for a new generation of riparian plants, and with them the critters. Also within the channel, operating a river where it's running 100 cubic feet per second one day and 1,000 cubic feet per second the next day plays havoc with the base of the food chain, the little benthic macroorganisms. If you time that change in flow inappropriately, then you're running a risk of wiping out certain classes of little critters, and therefore affecting the trout. And similarly, if you're running a lot of water out of the reservoir in the fall and the brown trout start spawning and then you drop the river, you kill the brown trout eggs and fry. So our project is looking at ways of sort of integrating all these consumptive water uses with better ways of doing flow, and better way to us is more like the natural hydrograph.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, you write very eloquently about what flooding does when you have water, as you just said, when you have water going onto the floodplain. It does so many things for the natural environment that are very important that don't happen when you keep the water only running in the channel. And presumably that's done because there are, what, people living on the banks that don't want to be flooded? I thought you weren't allowed to build on floodplains.
Well, that would be the ideal policy, and that's the stated policy. And the Mississippi River floods of the early 90s actually resulted in Corps of Engineers buying whole towns and moving them off the floodplain, which is a rather expensive expedient. But yeah, it's not a good idea to build on a floodplain. I see it all over, including the Rio Rancho area. But I think the real answer is, or at least what we're trying to do here, is manage floodplain river interaction in an area where there are only two landowners. One is the El Vado Ranch right below. It's a resort below El Vado Reservoir, and the Christ in the Desert Monastery way on down the way. Both of these ranchers or landowners of the church in one case, and David Cooper in another, are supporters of the project, and they're there. They see what values have been lost and what critters populations have been diminished over time, and they want to get some of these values back. So they're pretty thrilled about the idea that we could do business differently.
We're talking to Steve Harris about the Rio Chama. So when you have this project whose purpose is to take a very regulated, dammed, highly used, allocated, et cetera, river and make it flow in its natural manner, or more like its natural manner, how do you do that?
We've put together a team, and it's kind of interesting. These are all boaters like myself that love the Rio Chama. So we have a riparian ecologist, we have a fluvial geomorphologist, which means he's somebody that pays attention to how flows shape rivers and carry sediment.
That's a great title.
We got groundwater hydrologists, so that, you know, one thing people really don't understand about the river is it's intimately connected with its aquifers. It's a fundamental fact that sometimes we ignore at our own peril. And
explain that a little more.
Well, if I pump a well within, say, 2 or 3 miles of the river, sooner or later every gallon I pump out of that well is going to get removed from the river. So if somebody's depending on the river for their surface water rights for irrigation or drinking water or whatever, if I'm uncontrollably pumping, I am affecting the flow of the river. It can be to the detriment of, you know, water as property, or it can also be detrimental to the river as a natural system. and we need to account for this.
So how are you going about that?
So we've got a process. We've been collecting baseline data on various elements of the ecosystem, the benthic macroorganisms, the fish, the amphibians and reptiles, the songbirds, and other kind of like chemical and physical elements. And we've got the scientists are beginning to theorize about what influences them. So we came together last month with a bunch of reviewers, other outside experts from state and federal agencies, biologists and other engineers and geomorphologists, and did what we call a flow ecology workshop. And we broke into three discipline groups: the terrestrial biologists, the aquatic biologists, and the geomorphologists to come up with what they thought were important benchmarks and flows. So for most of them, the loss of flooding was a big deal. So trying to come up with a recommendation for periodically, if you flood, you get certain ecological benefits. If you avoid zeroing out, if you can't provide flows to maintain the fish don't get maintained. So it's important to pay attention to the low end of things so that you maintain the species you've got. And then various other operations that are keyed to the life cycle of birds and reptiles and other critters that live in the ecosystem to provide water on a schedule that we think would benefit them. And so we've come out with a sort of a Gantt chart that's an annual hydrograph or even like a decades hydrograph that every so often we want to hit all of these benchmarks. And then we're going to monitor and see if it had the effect that we were looking for, increasing populations, increasing biological diversity, you know, more different kinds of benthic macroorganisms indicates that the stream has gained some health. And then the trick is going to be to get everybody to buy into managing it that way, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what do you do? Do you allow flooding at certain preordained times?
The seasonality of the flood is really important because you look at the long-term record of flows in almost all of our Southwest rivers. May and June's the time you get the flood. That's where you get the regeneration, the recycling of nutrients, the new seed sources and so forth. And so it is we believe that it's important to do floods periodically at that season. And so the magnitude of those floods also matters because the reservoir is limited in what it can let out. It's only capable of putting out a quantity of 6,000 cubic feet per second. It's a good little flood in this stream, but it's compared to the historic floods, it's low magnitude. Historic floods are 11 to 14,000 cubic feet per second. So we're constrained by just the physical capacity of the system, plus the storage reservoir is there to store water. So you have to look carefully for opportunities to have big flow events. And all three groups actually recommended a return interval for a flood like that of 5 to 10 years. So we hope that we don't have long-term drought. We hope that we have the cooperation of the water rights holders and that we will be able to manage the system to get those floods. The other parts of the natural hydrograph are a little easier to manipulate. So
what do you mean by the natural hydrograph?
So in this system, high water in May and June, generally diminishing on into the summer, and so you have the natural hydrograph has low flows in July, August, September, even into October.
So we basically visualize a graph with numbers that are that represent the flow of water at any given time of year.
Yeah, so it's a big surge, a big high graph in the May and June period, gradually diminishing with many seasons will have a monsoon year, so that in August, September, October, some of July, you see little spikes of flow, little events that raise the flow, and then it recedes back to its base flow level. So we want something that looks like the natural hydrograph to the degree possible. We don't want it to zero out in the interest of grabbing more water into storage, or fail to flood and get over its banks and out onto its floodplain very many years in a row.
We're talking to Steve Harris about the Rio Chama. Now, there are always questions in New Mexico and in the West of you've got water flowing through the river and it's all allocated, and so river that is flowing upstream belongs to somebody downstream, but it also needs to be used upstream by the people and by nature. Is there a conflict there with the Rio Chama?
I think you've characterized generally a conflict in Western rivers. The Chama is a particularly appealing place to try and promote a natural hydrograph because the Rio Grande Basin gets 100,000 acre-feet of water out of the San Juan River Basin each and every year and runs it down the river. So it's actually got a subsidy of water, and the users are located far downstream. And so if we do an operation out of El Vado and it's not to the direct benefit of the downstream user, we can capture that water in Abiquiu Reservoir and re-regulate it and deliver it to the water user downstream schedule. So we refer to it as low-hanging fruit. We'd like to be able to manage other reservoir-controlled rivers to do this kind of operation, but the Chama is a particularly It's got good potential for doing these kind of operations.
Just because there is in that area enough water because of the different factors that you said.
And no irrigators in this 30-mile reach. It's actually a National Wild and Scenic River, so there's a lot of support from federal and state government for doing these kind of operations and improving fishing, rafting, ecological wildlife, hunting, all of those kind of values.
So what kind of wildlife do you have in and around the river, and how has that been changing as you've been observing the Rio Chama?
Well, we're just now getting the baseline data, so this is a rich birding area. We see a lot of raptors, bald eagles, osprey, whole suite of hawks, ducks and geese, and then our favored terrestrial animals like bears and elk and coyotes and so forth quite a bit. What the trends will be in population in the future is what we're trying to figure out here, trying to get things back into an appropriate balance.
So basically, the Chama being a wild and scenic river makes your job a lot easier.
Exactly, that's my point. But we do have sort of a hidden agenda that's a little larger with this project, is to show that we can do these kind of operations in ways that people will support, and that includes, the big water users, and it includes the local water users, the historic acequias in Abiquiu and Chama and those areas, and actually meet some of their unmet objectives. This has not been an optimally operated system for all of these people all of the time as well. So the ultimate product is, one, to put out an optimization hydrograph that it benefits recreation, it benefits the downstream users, it benefits the ecosystem, and sort of a balancing act. And we're going to do that with a pretty rich model of how the system operates. And then the other thing is to demonstrate that we can care for rivers in New Mexico better if we're willing to look into how they're supposed to operate and get consensus among people that depend on the river that, yeah, they want to get both sets of benefits, the usual traditional ones of consumptive use of water, but also the non-consumptive ones that are wildlife and ecology and beauty and recreation, spiritual values, all those things.
Which are very important to not only to people for aesthetic reasons, but basically when rivers die and become ugly, all the land around it is basically ruined and nobody wants to live there. So there's a huge economic impact to that kind of destruction, both on the level of ecological reality and aesthetics.
You know, I'm of the opinion that most of the destruction that's been wrecked on Western rivers has been entirely inadvertent or unintended. And I note that things are changing. The mindset is changing. You can go and talk to people that are not particularly environmentally conscious about the values that that a river could promote in their home community, and they're very receptive to this. And I get people of all stripes on my boat on river trips over the decades that are positively ecstatic about the experience of finally getting out into nature and interacting with flowing water. It does something to people's souls that's important. And so if you lose all your rivers in New Mexico, and we're, you know, the trend is in that direction. Certainly, you look at the L.A. River, the Gila River in Arizona, and some of those other rivers, they've ceased to function. And yet people want them back. Right. So that's the change that I see us responding to is, can you restore your rivers without sacrificing all the values that caused you to screw them up in the first place?
So talk about your own work as a river guide. Are you working mostly on the Chama River?
I love the Chama, and it provides an opportunity for multi-day family river trips that really you can't get in the Rio Grande. So we've got in New Mexico one river that's reliably flows through a beautiful wilderness area that's got all of these wonderful sort of amenities that people like to see, dinosaur footprints and ancient Indian cliff dwellings and pine-clad campsites and, you know, Colorado Plateau, colorful sandstone. And so, yeah, that's most of what I do in terms of guiding is those 2 and 3 day river trips where you get some time to get to know people and people get some time to get to know the river.
And you also, if you're looking at dinosaur footprints, you're also getting out of the boat.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would say in 30 miles of river, we probably spend no more than 10 hours boating in 3 days. But the rest of the time going from site to site, you know, picking out your favorite campsite and going and set up and build the campfire and serve lovely meals just like somebody could prepare at home. And, you know, all the amenities, cots, chairs, tables, tarps, beer, steaks.
So you are also, I mean, the stuff you're talking about now, you're also teaching, as we said at the beginning, flood rescue to all kinds of government agencies, municipal, state, federal. What do they come to you for? What are they looking to learn? How is that being implemented?
Well, you know, fire rescue departments have kind of evolved to a set of specialties, and everybody that joins a fire department gets trained to fight fires. But there are also things that they're called on to respond to, principally medical emergencies in a lot of communities, so the ambulance drivers, but collapsed buildings, flood rescue, the whole suite of different specialties, and I teach them how to respond appropriately according to national guidelines to flood events. So we'll be working next week with the Santa Fe City Fire Department to up their preparedness for some of these urban flooding events where you get folks driving off into low water crossings, and then what do you do?
It seems like, I mean, teaching flood rescue in a desert is almost an oxymoron.
Well, it is, and people don't recognize that they need, these departments don't recognize necessarily that they need this until 3 years ago in Ruidoso, suddenly the creek roared through and cut off a big swath of downtown. So Ruidoso realizes that every 10 years or 15 years, they're going to need to have this skill. Same things happened in Carlsbad. Same things happened in Las Cruces. Same thing happens frequently in the Gila River. And even if you don't if you've prepared appropriately for your usual spring runoff, you still have monsoon events that can be quite devastating. And, you know, with the way things are going with climate and global warming, these kinds of events are going to tend to be larger and more frequent in the future. Bigger droughts, but bigger floods, too.
Very interesting. Now, back to the Chama River, this whole Rio Chama flow project, I mean, you said, let's hope we don't have a drought going on for too long, because that would affect your ability to do this project and collect enough water to do the flooding when it's necessary. It seems like, I mean, we have a serious climate change situation that's affecting the West, that's affecting New Mexico, and it seems quite possible, if not likely, that we're going to have a long ongoing drought.
Well, we're not yet able to predict with any specificity what's going to go on in the future, but we can look to the tree ring data and see that some of these kinds of long-term precipitation deficits have lasted 6, 7, 8, 10, 13, and in some cases half a generation long, and so that's certainly always been a possibility here. So, for instance, we've had drier than ordinary conditions since 2007 here, and most of the reservoirs in New Mexico are at low ebb. Elephant Butte is probably under 10% of what it was designed to store. Elvado is maybe 5% of what it was designed to store. Heron is less than half of what it was designed to store. So that if we get two more years of meager snowpacks and light monsoons like we've had the last several, what do? We have to learn to live with that little amount that we get during a drought that nature is going to provide. I think it points to greater cooperation than we've had in the past. And one of the things that, as a policy person, I've been trying to sell is the idea of a soft path to water, so that the hard path, the sort of course we've been on since the 19th century, is to build large reservoirs, build pipelines, take water from where it is to where we want it to be. When population grows, or when a new industry wants to develop, or, you know, housing development occurs like Albuquerque, Phoenix, L.A., that we just go and find another source of supply. Well, now we're in a position of having to change direction and kind of adopt the soft path to water and look at reducing demands. And there's a lot of opportunities to do that. The United Nations has pegged the human need for water at about 15 gallons a person a day. And even in Santa Fe, where we sometimes pat ourselves on the back for being one of the more water conservation-oriented cities in the West, we're still using 70, 60, 80 gallons a person a day. So there are opportunities to do more. Not looking for new sources of supply, but rather paying attention to the demand side, a new water ethic. It's going to be a big change, but it's one of the suite of things that we have to do if we're facing more of these longer-term droughts down in the future.
There's always this question that comes up when we talk about water use and human consumption, and that is that 80 to 90% of water use is actually for agriculture, not for human domestic use. And I ask this question over and over, and I'm still trying to get a sense of how much does our personal use really matter compared to agricultural use? So we reduce, you know, let's say we reduce 10%, we reduce 50%, it's still a drop in the bucket compared to agricultural use.
This is really a nuanced question, but it's, I think, at the core of the discussions we need to be having about our water policy. The global economic experiment that's going on is, you know, stocks our grocery shelves with food, like, you know, prawns from Thailand and beef from Argentina and tomatoes from Mexico and so forth. If this experiment doesn't work so well, what do we do in terms of food self-sufficiency? So we can grow a lot more population than we can grow product using the available water. So the tendency throughout the West has been to transfer water off agriculture, you know, and the economics of agriculture are getting more difficult. So it's easy to talk a farmer off the farm and harder to talk the next generation of would-be farmers onto the farm. Once the water has been alienated from farms in the West, then you've lost that food production potential. So never mind that we're growing alfalfa for feedlots and dairies, those same acres could be our breadbasket in a time where food self-sufficiency is really important. So is it a smart policy then to feed economic aspirations and urban development on the backs of farmers' water rights? I don't think so. I think it's something that we should do with great caution. It's not the solution to all our problems. A lot of what we've done in terms of trying to find new supply is to raid aquifers that don't recharge. So we're actually building whole urban areas on top of water that's going to steadily diminish. And it's these are big, long-term policy questions that we need to confront if we intend that our kind is going to live in this arid environment very long.
We're talking to Steve Harris. Now, what about things like, I mean, when you talk about in cities or towns, people doing gray water, people making, using rooftop catchment and all those kinds of things, what does that do? Does it prevent water from flowing somewhere else when you're keeping it in your area? Does it help the situation?
That very question was a subject of debate for a number of years in New Mexico and Colorado both. And New Mexico has chosen to what I think is the wise course, which is to keep that water on the landscape it fell on as much as possible. And it also reduces demand on large-scale sources like aquifers and rivers. So in essence, I think it benefits the water system to do roof catchments and gray water recycling and that sort of stuff. The state policymakers have come to agree with that. It's been slower in Colorado, and it's just what you said. The argument is that if we start intercepting precipitation on our roofs and parking lots on a large scale, then we're not going to comply with our compact delivery obligations downstream, and the world as we know it will come to an end. Gradually, they're adopting this. This is, you know, an example of the new 21st century soft path to water.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess there's a lot of different aspects to that question, because one thing to catch the water on your roof, it's another thing to take your shower water and put it into your garden instead of putting it back into the sewer system where it flows somewhere else and gets reused. These are big questions. They're difficult questions. They're even difficult for us to wrap our heads around. How can regular citizens get involved? What should we do? How should we start thinking differently?
Well, I think that public involvement is probably the key to this change that needs to happen. I think educating oneself is important, and there are a number of folks that are styling themselves water educators like myself that are trying hard to devise ways of getting for people to directly get involved. I think managing the water right there on your own home is important. I think it's something that everybody can get a handle on and be more conservative. Think about the trade-offs. Water is such a magical substance that all of this is sort of complicated, you know, complex. We need to not leave these large-scale discussions and decisions to centralized planners. They don't always get the full range of what's going on in our communities. And so I think it's important that people get involved in water issues that are taking place in their community. And this sometimes seems like people are being asked to get into politics, and in a way they are, but I think this is more important than that. I think that, you know, the trends in where our water supplies are going and the inertia that we've built up for this development mentality that we'll just go get some more water and we can develop without limits absolutely must change, or there will be dire consequences. So sharing this ethic with one's neighbors, reading books like The Blue Revolution by Cynthia Barnett, talking with people, expressing themselves in, you know, let's really think what we need to do to ensure a sustainable future in this place. And a lot of this comes down to personal decisions that are made. Personal decisions are very important. We set examples for our kids. It took 150 years to develop the the consequences of all this development mentality around water. It's going to take at least half of that, two generations, to truly reverse and restore our relationship with the natural world. So we need to raise kids that are aware, and we can do that by setting good examples, installing the low-flow toilet, pulling out the lawn, putting in the xeriscape. You know, it's important because the way we think about water is the problem with water. People, you know, a lot of folks perceive that we've got a crisis brewing here. The media feeds that idea, and the fact is that there's the same amount of water on this planet as there's always been. So we just need to figure out how to use that better, not destroying ecosystems in the process and not wasting, so that we're taking something that could be very valuable to someone else, like a fish or a bird or another community.
Steve Harris is a river guide. He's director of Rio Grande Restoration. He is a teacher of river and flood rescue, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 28th of April at 11 in the morning, talking about the Rio Chama Flow Project. That's a presentation of Journey Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Roman Abeta. He's executive director of the Boys and Girls Club here in Santa Fe. Gabriel Rima of the Youth Media Project, his mentor and outreach coordinator there. And we are here to talk about Youth by Youth Fest, which is an event that's happening this coming Wednesday through Saturday. It's a collaboration among a whole bunch of people, the Boys and Girls Clubs and Youth Media Project, and also Warehouse 21, the Santa Fe Indian School Spoken Word Team, and the City of Santa Fe. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
So Youth by Youth Fest sounds like South by Southwest. What's actually happening?
Well, so I can speak to the event as a whole. Us over at Youth Media Project got together with the Boys and Girls Club, which is an emerging partner of ours. We've been doing some really cool work recently. Youth Media Project is located at Warehouse 21. So, you know, essentially we have all these different organizations which are in our periphery, and we wanted to just really build an event that culminated all these forces, brought them all together, and, you know, really made the best use of those relationships. So this sort of event basically emerged out of that desire. It's it's meant to be a symbiotic relationship, in the sense that, you know, each event feeds the other, and there's sort of that interplay. The first night is going to be a night of poetry on the 24th of April, brought to you by the Santa Fe Indian School. Night after that is going to be the Audio Revolution Live Showcase, which is going to be essentially just a showcase of live youth talent, all assembled by Youth Media Project and, you know, different youth we work with in the community. And then the last evening, that Friday, is going to be a Battle of the Bands put on by the Boys and Girls Club.
Nice. Tell us about the Battle of the Bands.
Sure. The Battle of the Bands is going to be, we're going to have four categories. General band category, solo singer / songwriter category, a DJ category, and hip-hop rap category. And it's restricted to teens only, because, again, this is a youth event, and we want to make sure that we highlight the different teens and the talent that we have in our community. We have lots of young bands. We have singer-songwriters. And so what we're doing is we've asked for submissions and each of the categories, and then what we are going to be doing is narrowing the submissions down to the top four in each category. And on the 26th at Warehouse 21, the top four in each category will compete. And
now, there's that many bands and musicians in all these different categories. What are we talking Santa Fe County? Are we talking about all of New Mexico, the Southwest?
Primarily Santa Fe County. And we've gotten quite a few submissions from the band category. And because of the limited amount of time, we're going to have to narrow it down to four, the top four in each category. And each performer or group will be given a 10 minute slot that evening on the 26th. And then in each category, they'll be first through fourth place, with the grand prize actually being an opening slot at Sosobra this year.
Oh, nice.
So we have a great partnership with Kiwanis, and they've agreed to allow our winners of our Battle of the Bands to perform for Sosobra. And this year will be the 89th annual Burning of Sosobra.
So do you expect lots of young people from all over the, basically from all over the area, to come and show up as audience as well?
Yeah, well, that's the hope. I mean, you know, this is, I think, in my opinion, this is a twofold sort of effort here, right? One is to give a stage and an outlet to the numerous talented young people in right under our noses in our community that just aren't seen because they don't have that stage, really. And then the hope is, the second hope, is that that will then inspire and act as a beacon for other youth in the area who, you know, are wanting to be involved in similar initiatives, similar work, who have similar talents, just sort of to be inspired by that. So yeah, the hope is that individuals will, you know, find out about it and get involved, and hopefully people who don't even know about any of the initiatives that we're working on will hear about this, somehow get involved, hooked off of this show, or, you know, somehow find out about it and come to join us.
And we're hoping long term that this becomes an annual event.
Right. And that sounds like it certainly could be, because this is the kind of thing where, let's say somebody's in the Battle of the Bands and they don't win that year, they're going to try really hard to get in it again the next year.
That's our hope. Exactly right. And we also need to acknowledge the city of Santa Fe, because the city of Santa Fe, they give us, the Boys and Girls Club has a grant for these types of events, to put on these events throughout the year. So they're really, that's allowing us to underwrite a lot of the costs for these three nights, because of course, you know, we have to have security, we have to pay Warehouse 21, of course, for the venue. There's some advertising involved, and it really, it wouldn't be possible without the city of Santa Fe and their support of our youth in our community.
Now, the Santa Fe Indian School wasn't able to make it today, but if we have time at the end, we're going to play a little piece from, they produced this unbelievably fabulous disc of their poetry, but they're going to be there too on the first night on Wednesday night doing a spoken word poetry performance. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And I can personally speak to the power of their poetry. I mean, I, through Youth Media Project, actually hosted a show with some of these performers a couple years back, and they just, you know, do it like nobody else in Santa Fe. Tim McLaughlin and Nolan, which are the two active mentors in the poetry over there, really, really know what they're doing. So
they do indeed. They're unbelievable. So all this is happening. Now let's talk just a little bit about the Boys and Girls Club.
Sure. The Boys and Girls Club, we have seven facilities altogether. We have our main Alto site, and then we have smaller clubs throughout Santa Fe County, and we just recently merged with Del Norte Boys and Girls Club, so now we're also running the Boys and Girls Clubs in Chimayo and Abiquiu. So altogether we have seven clubs, and one thing that we're really trying to do is create partnerships with other youth-serving organizations, and that's how we originally got hooked in with Youth Media Project and Warehouse 21. We can't provide everything that our children need in our community by ourselves. There are certain things we do really well, and there's certain things that other groups like Youth Media, Warehouse 21 does well. And so my vision as the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club is, let's focus on what we do well, and let's partner with organizations that can do other things and provide other programmings that we can't for our kids.
Mm-hmm. And the Youth Media Project, which produces Audio Revolution on KSFR, is going to be doing their annual showcase on Thursday night, the 25th, and that's also a really incredible show, and I want to send a shout-out to Judy Goldberg, who's been at it for a long time and mentoring people and bringing up people like you, Gabriel, to really bring in a new generation of audio producers.
She's the backbone. She's the mind. You know, she's enables this work to happen, along with the numerous other individuals involved.
So this event, Youth by Youth Fest, is free to people 19 and under.
Yes.
And then adults have to pay. They can either get a block ticket for all three nights or pay per event. It's Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and it's all happening at Warehouse 21.
And the end of, I just want to add, at the end of the night on the 26th, at the end of the Battle of the Bands, we're going to have one of our, a local band, Thieves and Gypsies. They were just, they just received the Best of Santa Fe band category this year, and they're not quite teens, but they're in their young 20s, and they've agreed to kind of be the headliners at the end of the night, and they're also going to be around to talk to the musicians, the younger musicians, about what it takes to be a band, what kind of commitment is required, and just any other questions that any of these young artists may have for them.
Romano Beta is executive director of the Boys and Girls Club. Gabriel Rima of Youth Media Project, he's the mentor and outreach coordinator there. Once again, April 24th through 26th, Wednesday through Friday, Youth by Youth Fest. If people want more information, is there a website?
You can find out more about it certainly at our website at youthmediaproject.org. We have all the information.
If you're a band or an artist, solo artist, DJ, or hip-hop rap, you can contact Jonathan Salazar. He is our team coordinator, and his phone number is 470-0983.
And we're going to go out with a piece by the Santa Fe Indian School Spoken Word Poetry Team. Roman and Gabriel, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Saya kini saya ne wo ye
Yana huwe, yana huwe, yana huwe ne ne huwe yohan. Yana huwe. The new generation, history carved this creation, modern form of meditation. Oh, oh, we are the new generation, history carved this creation, modern form of meditation. So are you gonna listen?
Nihil John Shahe, I have a story. In the beginning,
there was the word,
and it was spoken.
Native Americans saying,
for centuries, our people told stories
that saved our minds from complacency
and our hearts from ignorance of the past.
Our spiritual offering to the world
through language
wrapped in the breath of elders
who hold our creation,
our history
on their tongues.
We youth spin modern truth to rhythms.
We speak
to know who we are.
We write
to remember who we were. Bring the beat
back to when we could see the sky.
Before we were blinded by buildings.
When our ancestors
scratched stories of our place in the universe
onto rock walls.
Now we bomb
desert brown
and sky blue
onto buildings.
Like colors make it possible to fly again.
We paint pottery designs.
Not to prostitute our cultures,
but to show their beauty.
Bring the beat
back
to a time when the land's
thunderous heartbeat was crafted by drums.
We sang to connect with the heavens.
Rain.
Blessed droplets.
Purified.
And protected us.
7 generations later.
We sing.
To remember those who have gone before.
They've become the perfect soil.
To grow our cultures.
Instrumental and acapella vinyls.
Mashed together in revolutions called remixes. Bring the beat.
Back.
To an earth's pulse.
Echoed through our souls.
Swirling clouds padded the sky.
We drank music through rain.
Dance was a prayer.
To land.
Plants.
Animals,
wind,
sky,
clouds,
spirits.
Dust seeped into our skin
and dripped from our feet,
rooting us to earth.
Now we pray through dance floors, turntables, spray cans,
and microphones.
From the roots
to the fruits,
we are our ancestors.